Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ventures, a new show where my guests and I get to explore entrepreneurial stories, problem spaces, market landscapes, and examine together how new products and services, whether for-profit or nonprofit, can be built to benefit humanity. Today's episode is all about blockchains, the state of the blockchain ecosystem here in summer 2020, the nuances between proof of stake and proof of work, and we define lots of different terms like validator nodes and how data can be brought forth to developers and accessed by developers in order to build a new generation of decentralized applications. So my guests, Lorian and Andy, are co-founders of a company called Figment Networks, and they provide a wide range of services for networks that are growing, then, and we'll be defining what all those different services are. And my third guest is Tony. He's my older brother and works in industry at a large scale. And so we'll be talking about the differences between enterprise consortiums and how those start versus new networks that are starting from scratch. Now, as a disclaimer, Figment Networks is a portfolio company of a group that I'm a general partner of called Proda Ventures. And if you're watching this episode, you can also listen anywhere that you get your podcasts. And if you're listening, you can watch this episode by visiting wclittle.com. So with that, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation. All right, welcome. Really excited for the show. Andy, Lorian, Tony, really appreciate having you guys here.
Hey, Will.
Hey, glad to be here.
Good to be here. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. So, Lorian, I'd love to start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, background, how you got into the blockchain space, and a little bit about Figment.
Great. So I'm one of the three co-founders of Figment Networks. Professionally, let's see. We have started businesses that when you put them together, look a lot like what it takes to run a blockchain business. So we started off in the ISP space in the early 90s, dating ourselves a little bit, but one of those out of our parents' basement stories in the early 90s, almost pre-browser, and grew that company, one of the first commercial ISPs in Canada to a couple hundred employees. And then following the exit there, we started a national data center and hosting company where we took old bank mainframe data centers and brought them up to internet spec. And AT&T acquired that company in the early 2000s and then moved on to a cloud security startup, email startup, one of the first companies that was basically filtering email for spam and viruses, et cetera, in the cloud. So, you know, Andy can talk about what he did, but he was in databases. And so when you put all those skills together and all those businesses together, you basically get a blockchain. So networking, data centers, databases, and security. And when you put that all together, you kind of have the description of a distributed ledger. So that's my background, always professionally.
So those early ventures, that was you and Matt, Matt's your brother-in-law?
That's right. And then we met Andy a couple years ago, actually through you. He was stupid enough to join two brothers as a co-founder who had started three, four businesses together. So
nice. Well, welcome, Andy. Glad to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, yeah. How you got into the space.
Sure. So, sort of in a parallel universe to Lorian and Matt, while they were co-founding companies, I was sort of doing the same track, but instead of doing it in Canada, I was doing it in Chicago. So had a chance to start my career in software at Motorola and then quickly found out I was a terrible employee and quit and started a company since then. Had a chance to do bootstrapping and raise some capital for some and sell some and shut some down. And so luckily at my last company, one of the employees was mining on our servers in the early 2010s. And so that's when I kind of figured out what Bitcoin was. And really, once Ethereum came around, is what kind of piqued my interest. And from all the narratives of world computer to DeFi, I still think there's a lot of interesting things happening in the space, and I kind of was keeping excited. And had a chance to sort of start Figment with Matt Loring and sort of explore the what could happen with proof of stake. And that's really where we've been focused for the past couple of years.
Nice. And you and I met, you and I met in Chicago, right? And we were talking about blockchain. Remind me of that.
I was trying to figure this out, Will. And I think that it was my landlord, Chris Deutsch, who you were working out of his space in the basement. And he said, "Hey, you're doing a startup. You should talk to this guy." And so I think that's how it happened. I'm not exactly sure, but I was trying to figure out like, how will those random sort of geographic happenstances work in the future? Will we be hanging out in the same Clubhouse channel or in Zoom? Like, it just happens that we knew a landlord that we were in the same building. So I'm glad that happened, but I want to sort of figure out how to foster more of that in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And Chris, thank you when you're watching and listening. So Tony, glad to have you back. Obviously you and I have been chatting blockchain for a while. Tell us a little bit quickly about your background and how you got into blockchain.
Sure. So as you noted, the blockchain entered my world with you and I in a conversation we had back Easter, what was it, 2015 maybe? Something like that, maybe earlier. And I work for Optum, which is the technology and services company underneath United Health Group. So United Health Group owns United Healthcare and Optum. For the longest time, United Healthcare was the big brother, and now it's the little brother in terms of revenue. So at that, the business has certainly grown. I'm a physician, non-practicing, a technologist. And what you did is you said, "Hey, what is Optum doing blockchain?" And I was like, I had no idea what blockchain was, of course. And so I was like, let me go check it out. So I, you know, went down the rabbit hole like everyone else does when they first learn about it, try to understand exactly how it impacts the current landscape of infrastructure today for technology and how it might change in the future, what that looks like. And I met a guy named Conrad Barsky, if he's listening, hey, sir, another physician. And then he and I and another doc entered a challenge that the ONC, the Office of National Coordinator for the government, as a thing like, how could blockchain change healthcare? So we, mostly Conrad did most of it. I helped to edit some things and add my own background around data and technology and healthcare that I'd been working on for quite some time. And we published it, Blockchain Computing Systems in Healthcare. And then it just went kind of, you know, snowballed from there. End up meeting the team working on blockchain, a very nascent team at Optum. And started looking at how do we change the way that healthcare looks at solving problems that no one company or entity can solve just themselves. And that's how we sort of started thinking about how do we use blockchain in a more of an enterprise-like style and how it could intersect at some point with public blockchains. And that's been my interest for quite some time now.
Awesome. Glad to have you here. Thanks for joining. So Lori and Andy, tell us more about Figment. What's the story? What are you up to now? What kind of problems are you seeing in the space, and how are you getting after them?
You want to take this one, Andrew?
Sure, happy to. As I mentioned earlier, we sort of came together around this idea that there's a technology shift or a new technology emerging. So I mentioned that was called proof of stake. And so proof of stake is a sort of technical detail, and you could think of it as a niche within a niche. So blockchain is its own thing, and proof of stake is its own little thing within it. But what we saw was this technology shift that said, hey, this might allow more new blockchains to be launched. New blockchains that have new novel features, have unique things they're attempting. But you know, when we were getting started, there was two predominant chains, which was really Bitcoin and Ethereum. There were other chains, but they had a lot of overhead in getting started. And so what we said was, could a lot of new chains be launched with this new technology proof of stake? And let's just start working in that. And so if you start pulling on that thread, it's how do you help these new ideas, these new proof of stake based blockchains get launched? Once that happens, how do you get people using them, participating in them? And you know, what we've been really kind of focused on lately is once these we've seen these chains launching, so that part's coming true. New proof of stake chains are launching. How do you get people building on them? How do you attract developers? And so that's sort of been the path we've been on, which is we started with this idea that there's a technology shift, there's a new technology available, and what could be done for it. And so to sum it up, the way we're thinking about proof of stake and the reason why we focused on it is we think it's sort of like one way to think of it is it's a new platform in a way that smartphones or mobile was a new platform, right? Mobile gave us new things like GPS sensors. So now you have location in your app. That's new. And what can developers do with it? We think that some of these new novel proof of stake chains will give us equivalents to those GPS sensors, and they're going to give developers new tools. And so we got to get the platform stood up. We got to get people using them, but then we have to really think about how can we get developers building new unique tools that could not be built any other way on proof of stake. And so that's been our own journey as Figment through this space.
That's great. That's great. So backing up a minute, for the viewers and listeners that are maybe not familiar with blockchain, or they were super into it in 2017 and early 2018 before the big crash and bear market came, what is a blockchain? Let's take a quick step back and Andy or Tony or Lorian, what is it?
Yeah, I think Tony has a unique perspective on this idea of, I'm getting into one of the details, which is sort of private versus public, but maybe I can take a stab at the consensus view of what a public blockchain is, like maybe Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then Tony, maybe if you want to add a little bit of details about how you view them and sort of the private flavor of it. But the way I think about a blockchain is a lot of times I make a reference to something like PayPal. If I want to send you something on PayPal, I just send it, to your email address, and it sends through this central party, which is PayPal Inc. And hopefully they'll let you take out the money. I'm talking about a payments use case here. But if PayPal decides to hold up the payment, they can do that. They can shut down your account. One way to think about a blockchain is instead of having a single entity PayPal, what if we had a group of 100 people who all had to sort of come to consensus as sort of this this group, and together everyone says, yes, this is a valid transaction, so therefore it goes through. There's no single person that could stop me from sending something to Will. That's one way to think of a blockchain in terms of this payment use case. But in general, the underlying principle is we're taking centralized architectures and decentralizing them, taking it from a single point of failure to sort of systems that come together on consensus. Groups of entities sort of operating and sort of coming to a general consensus. That's the way I think about it from sort of a public blockchain using this payments use case. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And Tony, I think at one point you gave me a Harry Potter reference or a Harry Potter analogy for what, do you remember what that was?
Oh my gosh. No, but the one that I usually use to piggyback on what Andy was just saying was, if you think about it, like if you get into a bar and two people get in a fight, what's the first thing you generally do, right? Everyone looks for the guy, usually with the round glasses, with the greasy hair, usually the accountant, and everyone places bets on who's going to win. And the way it generally works, the way it generally worked then is that the guy would take all the money, right? And then whoever won, he'd dash some out and he'd take some in the middle. There's no other great way for all these people to really solve this problem of being able to place bets unless you had that bookie in the middle, right? That person you decide on, that person would take rent, extract rent from it as transaction fee for doing the work. It's no different than in today's age, or maybe in the recent past, if everyone wanted to understand what the weather was like, if everyone had to flip on the TV or maybe get the newspaper, or everyone had to walk outside or call a service or something to try and figure out what the weather may be. How do you use technology to sort of start, reducing the cost of that? Obviously, I have a weather app now, but how do we sort of do that similarly with these more complex problems, which is really a contract between you and that bookie to say, you need to tell me who won, and we're all looking at it, and we can all see it together to say who won, and then you just sort of pay out based on that. So in the permission space, instead of it being a bunch of people in a bar, it's a bunch of companies in a business ecosystem who have to do something together that's rather complex. And so what we're doing is we're looking, at least the way I see it, is blockchain enables the technology to make that happen. It also enables the economics of making that happen in a new and different way. And it provides a governance structure to allow you to manage it all. Mm. And it combines these things in a new and innovative way that had never been seen before. And so every business that already has a business struggles with the new model. Mm. So one of the challenges associated with blockchain today is walking through the leaders of these business, people who hold the purse strings, and understanding what that looks like, the risk to their business, the benefit to their business. And it's just been a very slow evolution. And at United, we have pioneered, along with a number of other healthcare payers, a blockchain called the Synaptic Health Alliance that is trying to do that. It has United, it has Aetna, it has Humana, it has a lot of the big national payers trying to solve some really basic problems first, see what the value is, and then extending it from there. Hmm. So blockchain can be used in that way, but the problem has to be really big, right? It has to be a really big problem that everyone can't solve themselves. And if everyone participates, everyone wins. And that's a very different model than a majority of the capitalistic sort of market forces that exist today in healthcare and in any, you know, any market across the US and the world, honestly.
Yeah.
So blockchain is a pretty big deal if you look at it that way. And that's why I'm excited about it.
Yeah. I think I would add to those descriptions that it's a way of verifying the originality of information and therefore creating true digital scarcity of a piece of information or a digital good, which mm-hmm. I think is either an outcome or use case or a basic definition of blockchain, depending on the way you come at it.
Right. And just to piggyback on that, because it's a beautiful way of saying, in some ways, in healthcare, is if there's a company that has a piece of information that can be useful to everyone, how do you land it, keep track of it, keep track of who has access to it, who benefits from it, and bring that value back to the originator? That's something that is really hard on the internet, because you can make a copy of stuff and send it everywhere. There's no great way for everyone to agree that this person owns this, they delivered it, it delivered value, and then we're going to reward them. That's very difficult in the standard way the internet's created today.
Yeah, and at a very, very, very basic level, the Harry Potter-esque analogy that I think you gave me at one point, Tony, was that you can imagine 10,000 parchments or little pieces of paper up in the air and somebody writing on one of the pieces of paper, and then it just magically, that transaction or that writing magically gets copied to all the other pieces of paper, so that any one piece of paper has the exact copy of what's written or what's transacted on that ledger, and it's very distributed. So let's talk a little bit about, and I really appreciated that analogy. So for the viewers and listeners that are new to the space, we're gonna go down one level deeper, as Andy mentioned earlier, and talk a little bit about proof of stake versus proof of work. And then we're going to dive into a little bit more of the weeds here. So apologies if we lose any of you, but I think a number of our listeners are fascinated at a little bit more of the layers here. So let's take a moment. I don't know if Andy, do you want to take a stab at how would you define what is proof of stake? What is proof of work? Why does that matter in the blockchain ecosystem?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll try to come at this first from maybe what the data looks like, and then how we come to agree what the data looks like, because there's two pieces to it, which is you mentioned the word ledger, and it's definitely part of it. The way to think about a ledger is we agree what the state of the world looks like right now, and then some things happen, and then there's a new state of the world, and you sort of have a list of all these states of the world. And to make that less abstract, in the payments example I was saying earlier, you know, the current state of the world is Will's balance is 10 and mine is 50, and then I send something to Will, and now my balance is decreased to 40 and Will's has increased to 20, right? Those are two states of the world sort of linked together by this sort of payment or this transaction in between. And so really that's kind of what the blockchain is getting after, is how do you come to consensus about these individual states of the world? And then how do you transition between the states, the payment itself, in this case, I'm using the application of a payment. And so the way that it was done on really the first blockchain, which is Bitcoin, the real novel breakthrough was this concept of proof of work, which basically there's a competition for who gets to say that these are the transactions that happened. And I get to sort of collect them all together and commit them as the new state, the new way the world looks. And the way it works is, again, this is a vast simplification. The way it works is that you have to solve a sort of arbitrarily complex math puzzle that requires you to burn a ton of resources, CPU, GPU, you know, as it's evolved over time. So it's basically, it's expensive for you to claim that all these transactions occurred and then the new state of the chain is something. And so you have to prove that you're doing the work. You have to prove that you're burning a bunch of CPU cycles, burning a bunch of you know, GPU work to sort of make these transitions. And so that has led to a fascinating ecosystem of these sort of miners, your proof of work miner, if you're doing this work, to sort of update the blockchain with a new block, with the new state of the world. It's evolved into, you know, there's multiple public companies who now make these miners. It's a global phenomenon that has tons of second order effects. And the overall thing to understand about it is it's incredibly resource intensive. What these miners are doing to help secure these networks or to help make sure each transaction is valid. Contrast that with what if we didn't have to put all these new, you know, miners and equipment out in the world? What if there was a way to essentially risk your reputation, risk your assets, as opposed to just burning arbitrary CPU? And this is where proof of stake comes in. The big breakthrough with proof of work was you could verify that you ran all these complex computations and everyone could see that you did it. With proof of stake, you're basically saying, I have some asset, such as, you know, I'm willing to bet or willing to lay on the line $100 that I'm telling the truth. And if someone could prove to me that I'm not, then they can take my money. And so the benefit of this approach is you don't have to burn all the CPU cycles. It's effectively placing bets, putting up, you could think of it like putting up collateral. And that's the difference between proof of work and proof of stake. The benefit of proof of stake is you can have networks that have high levels of security without having to have these, you know, global mining infrastructure. You can make more networks faster is really what it comes down to is how I think about it.
That's great. Yeah, because the basic three layers of a blockchain, just any blockchain, right, has to have consensus, right? All those different pieces of paper have to agree on what is the state. There has to be networking and complicated protocols between the different nodes to make sure that they can communicate effectively. And then there needs to be some kind of management of the state. There needs to be essentially an application layer that is programming how the change of state happens. Is that essentially a summary of those three?
Yeah. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. The maybe as a teaser to look ahead, I keep using the example of payments because it's very easy to understand. You know, number go up, number go down, right? As I send money, but you could track other state changes. There's other things you could track, and I think that's where when I think about the applications of blockchain, the applications of some of these proof of stake networks we're seeing, that's where it becomes really interesting. I've seen examples of there's new sort of Wi-Fi or wireless based networks, which prove how much data you've used over time. So instead of, you know, just sending like payments back and forth, it could actually be usage of an asset, something like that. And so there's lots more you can do if you think about, okay, I'm just keeping a list of the previous states of something as opposed to, you know, I'm just sending money around. There's more to be done than just tracking payments.
So go ahead, Tony.
Hold on just a minute. Well, one way I think of it too, to piggyback on what Andy was saying, is if you think about it, proof of work, the reality is it's proof of stake surrounded by proof of work to create consensus today in like Bitcoin and Ethereum. What I mean by that is you have to take a bunch of your money, go and buy a bunch of hardware. You're already staking, but it requires the complexity of adding randomization due to this hash rate, which is really not that random, because if you spend more money, if you have more stake, you actually work harder on the network and then get more Bitcoin back or Ethereum back as a reward. So what you can do is instead of having that hardware in the middle, you go in and just buy the asset, the actual currency, the coin, the token from the network. And then there's just software that determines the randomness of who goes, randomness in quotes, based on how much you stake. So it's a slightly different model, but reality is it's sort of an evolution of it to say, how do we just make this more efficient? And to the point of the group here, how are we able to then stand up these blockchains still securely without having the infrastructure challenges associated with just the consensus itself? You still need really good infrastructure. So Figment Networks does a great job based on their history Lori and Matt and Andrew and others there of understanding how do you create infrastructure to make sure the technology works. But in a proof of stake way, you don't have to then spin up all this additional hardware to make a consensus decision. And I think that's really where I think it's just this natural evolution of proof of work, honestly.
Yeah, I think one of the things, Lorian, that you've talked about with me and mentioned to me before is, Tony, you mentioned that it takes sort of these assets and proof of stake to run these systems. But I led with the example of PayPal saying, you know, having a central entity is bad. If I saying there's this decentralized network or these multiple entities, will it tend towards centralization? And are we just recreating the existing system all over again? When you talk of, you know, kind of getting the weeds of custody and things like that. I think, Lauren, you spent a little bit of time thinking about that and sort of seeing how it plays out. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but that's one of the things that we've seen and watched in the space.
Yeah, it's an interesting question about how much decentralization is desired. Is that an endpoint or part of the function or not? And I don't think people really agree on that. What qualifies as decentralization? And again, how important it is, and whether it's a goal in itself or just an output of these blockchains. So I think that's still an open question, but you're seeing lots of factors which might point to sort of re-centralization, whether it's large scale usage of custodians, which are especially regulated. Custodians would be a single point of failure, and so how the or exchanges, you know, large single exchanges holding many tokens in a given network, whether that's really that decentralized, any different from the PayPal example. So I think those are open questions and we'll see. And I don't think a lot of the circumstances people envision blockchains being useful for have been tested in a real world situation.
Now, it's interesting, Lorian, you mentioned that in the enterprise space, it's sort of the opposite. I don't know if the opposite is the right way to say it, but the reality is there's usually one company that wants to start this. So there's a tremendous amount of centralization to start. And your goal is generally to try and bring all these other entities in to decentralize it enough so that people trust it. It's almost like before, security was a property of a network in that either had security or it wasn't secure, or it wasn't secure enough, like in a very basic sense. With blockchains, it's actually a value proposition, right? So you look at it and look at security as a real decision point around, do you participate or not? It'll be interesting to see if these proof of stake networks, if all of the tokens end up in one person's bucket, then you haven't really, you've still lost the decentralization. Therefore, they can change it and no one knows. That's the decision point. Is it going to exist 10 years from now? And you're still, the same records are going to be in the database. So those kind of things that you kind of think through.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the ecosystem. Let's paint the picture of what are the different components? Who are the different players? How is it set up? Like, what is a protocol? What is a decentralized application? What are the different companies and the different networks, and how do they play a role? And I don't know if you want to start or if somebody else wants to take that one.
Sure. Yeah, so sure. Did you say Lauren or Andrew? I didn't catch it.
Yeah, Andrew, you can start.
Yeah,
go ahead.
we'll throw darts at each other. Let's see. If you want to take a look at least in the case of a stake-based network, usually what you have is a founding team, a centralized company. It's either a foundation or a team, and they may be venture funded or they may not be. And they will essentially launch the protocol in a fairly centralized manner. And then at the next level, you will have token holders, people who've invested in that team/protocol, which has to be launched. And so they're the people that own the stake. And they bought the stake with fiat, regular currency. And then you have a set of infrastructure providers like Figment Networks, who then start to run the computers, the nodes on that network, and then have a relationship with those token holders who stake those tokens with them. And then from there, you'll have a set of you can call them layer two, layer three, essentially data providers or people who are helping manipulate the protocol to either make it more accessible, to pull data out of it, to build the tools, and then finally you'll have the applications who are hopefully building on that infrastructure in a way that wasn't possible in a traditional Web 2 environment, for example. And then over time, if things are successful, the founding team foundation becomes less and less important. They're no longer, quote, running, unquote, the protocol, because it's now in the hands of a fairly decentralized base of token holders, infrastructure providers, and application users and developers. So I think that that's generally what the roadmap should look like. And, you know, it's still pretty early, but you're starting to see some of that happen in some of the networks that have been around longer, such as Tezos or Cosmos, which are probably the longest lived, well-known networks. But I think that that's the general ecosystem and path which these networks are taking and ought to take.
Very, very well said. Andrew, Tony, anything to add to that?
One thing I would add is the analogy that the Brian Bedendorf, who is the leader of the Hyperledger project, which is a blockchain software technology that's being used more in the enterprise space, use the analogy of a homeowners association, where you have the developer creating a development and you get more and more houses in it, and eventually you kind of turn it over. To Lauren's point, at some point you sort of give control over and create this homeowner association that then those who are participating control the network, if you will. That's sort of the analogy used, and that the ideal state is that, and it's very similar to how these permission networks work. That's and right. We're trying to move it more toward public. So Lorian right. Nailed it on that. I do have a question though.
Yeah, I'll just add sort of one thing. I would just add is often, even though the foundations are no longer making the governance decisions, at some point in time, they often will they keep a large voice in them, or at least their voice is important. And then they also, with the money they've raised, will often act as an incentive mechanism to get people to do things on the network to help grow the network. So very often they have a large treasury or know people, and they're actively working to get people to actually use these networks in various ways. So it's like the developer in that analogy continues to try and either bring on additional developers to build out, you know, infrastructure, and it's still sort of working behind the scene to add value to the homes that have been built there.
Yeah, so that's great. So in this landscape, then, where does Figment lie specifically? Where does your company fall and add value and try to solve problems in this ecosystem?
Yeah, the I think it emerges. It has emerged for us over time. It's clear where we wanted to start, and we've sort of been guided along in the past few years. So, like I said, we created the company around this concept of this new technology, and the key benefit is you could launch new blockchains. So that's where we started. How do we help these new blockchains launch and get off the ground? We haven't said the word yet, but one of the key terms, one of the key things we do is called a validator. So in the PayPal example I gave, there's one company which just says all the transactions are valid. In the blockchain example, that is sort of broken up into hundreds of people. And these people's roles, the title is a validator. You're validating the transactions that are going through. So you actually get, as a validator, Figment Networks is a validator, you get a little compensation for your work on the network, for making sure everything is valid. And so that's where we started. And so to launch networks, you need validators. So Figment Networks is one of those validators. And we continue to do that today. We are, you know, a trusted validator with a great track record and all of those things. And so that's where we started. And the key thing we're trying to do is create a coalition or a group of validators so we can launch a new network. And we've done that, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 times now. And there's a bunch more coming. Once a network is launched, you need to put the stake in proof of stake. The token holders, the people who are going to be securing the network, have to stake. And that's where we really tried to come in next, was how do we get this engagement from these token holders? How do we let people know what the heck is happening on these newfangled blockchains? And so the gap we saw there was no analytics tool. There's no way for a person to just look at a blockchain and say, who are the players on this? What's sort of the history of these validators? What's happening on the network? And so we created this software tool called Hubble. Hubble, like Hubble Telescope, is a way for you to look at blockchain networks. It's live on 10 networks today, and we're adding more over time. And so we're sort of going down this path of sort of network maturity, of network launches, people start staking on it so that it becomes secure. And so once a network is launched and secure and usable, then people can start building on it. Developers can start using it. And that's really the newest focus for us is a product we're creating called Data Hub, which is a way for developers to access blockchain networks. And we're not talking about sort of people who already get blockchain, people who are already crypto natives. It's actually a product for everyone else. How do you make Web 2 developers into Web 3 developers? How can you sort of present all the complexities and nuances of a blockchain in a familiar API or interface? And we really want to bring new developers in to try to build on these blockchains. And to kind of bring it all the way home, we saw a technical shift with proof of stake, and we thought that it could enable new use cases to be discovered, new killer apps, in the way that, you know, GPS enabled killer apps on mobile. And so our whole thing is, how do we get these blockchains launched? How do we get them secure? How do we get developers building on them so that these killer apps can be discovered? And that's how you really sort of get breakthrough changes, breakthrough new things that people can use. And that's really been our North Star so far.
So is there a community of these validators, right? If I'm looking to start up a new network and I want to do a proof of stake, a consensus mechanism, at what point do I talk to Figment? At what point do I talk to you? And do I bring a whole crew to the table and try to convince them first? Or if I'm starting a network, how would I think about the steps of building that network?
Yeah, so great question. Certainly if you want to launch, in our experience, we get approached pretty early on, pre-launch of a new network or protocol, because one thing you require is a set of competent operators and a diversified set of operators running those nodes as a way to kickstart that network. So yeah, you would definitely talk to someone like ourselves, just basic, you know, just to have the infrastructure in existence, but also because we've been through probably close to 50 network launches now. So we've seen a bunch of best practices that work and don't work. So just from a knowledge distribution perspective and sort of what you should and shouldn't be looking out for as you launch a protocol, we usually add value in that area too.
So speaking
of...
Go ahead.
Sorry, Will. One more thing I want to add there is I agree that this is sort of a gap, which is how do you speak to this community of validators? Do you just have to know what their names are? You know, to try to solve that, we've created a Telegram group called Staking Hub. We're supposed to be sort of a high quality place where networks can come and sort of we do AMAs where the network you can ask them anything they want. And they're really speaking to, you know, recruiting some of these early validators, recruiting some of these people that might become token holders and stakers on their network. And so we've done a little bit to try to address it. But I think it's sort of an ongoing thing that if we really want to move the space forward, it could be improved.
Yeah. So you all have an amazing vantage point. I mean, you've seen 15 of these, you've been up close and personal with 15 of these launches. And you know, you mentioned best practices and sort of do's and don'ts, Lorian. What are those best practices? What are those things that you've seen that are good? And what are those things that you're like, probably shouldn't do that if you're spinning up a new network?
Ooh, that's you could take that in a lot of different ways. I would say there are some really basic project planning and what you would call the traditional production function of organizations, in that hitting dates, having good project plan. I know it sounds really simplistic, like no kidding, but there are a number of examples of teams who just don't have a good a good way to actually ship code effectively. Mm-hmm. And so you get poor communication, and you also have to figure out how to communicate outside of a traditional company. So, you know, there are some really blocking and tackling type activities, which really actually differentiate some of the teams, which again seems silly in this area. I'm like, no kidding, but being able to effectively communicate with your ecosystem and a bunch of people and companies across time zones and geographies, and then also being able to hit dates, communicate those dates, is actually doesn't exist in more cases than you would think of. So that's kind of one really like simplistic example. But then you also have to figure out your token mechanics and incentives. That's a big part of it. You know, if you get that right, then a lot of the work is done with you because people will be incented financially basically to participate. And then there's a bunch of sort of community building skills, which are softer skills outside of sort of hard economic incentives that I think you have to focus on. And the networks that are doing well have really focused a lot on effective community building and getting people to engage and care essentially beyond just sort of simple economic incentives, which even if it's super well designed can be fairly far out. So I would think that's sort of three areas that people should focus on and offer.
Yeah, Tony, I'm really curious if you have anything to add here, because I want to make a contrast, which is one of the, I'm making a bit of a broad stroke here, but a lot of the teams that we see launching new networks come out of research, academia, sort of theory approach. And so, you know, productionizing theory is always very challenging. And so you have teams which, as Lauren said, are not used to, you know, infrastructure, calling their shot, communication, all that kind of stuff. And it's sort of the Wild West. Some of the teams are even anonymous. You don't know who they are. They just communicate, you know, via avatars and things. So that's one end of the spectrum. You mentioned Hyperledger earlier and sort of this other people are making more enterprise-style blockchains. What have you seen for that end of the spectrum versus launching a new network using using something that's made for sort of enterprise adoption?
Yeah, it's a challenge because if you look at it from an enterprise perspective, now you have these companies that have their own operational processes coming together and trying to create something together. And so there's a lot of politics associated with who does what, how do you communicate? You have to put together a memorandum of understanding, honestly, between those groups coming in. And then you often create a company over the top of it. That would be some sort of generally a non-for-profit that would sort of manage the blocking and tackling of the groups related to the blockchain. That's been the model that's been tried. And it has some various levels of success, but it's the same kind of problems that Lorien mentioned, right? So you have to take these companies that are all different, that all have different styles, different development styles. Some may be using Agile, Waterfall, you know, just a bunch of people just working code, have to come together and decide, what are we going to do? How are we going to say what we're going to do? How are we going to recruit? What does that look like? With the Synaptic Health Alliance, we had actually a lot of people very interested, but we didn't want to bring 50 people in right away, right? We started with four or five founding members, and it's really complicated. And to your point, like what the blockchain is, in quotes, at a very high level, the why of the blockchain is the way you differentiate it. Underneath it, the use cases is what it is, and it should support that vision. You know, so Ethereum says it's just like the world computer, it's everything. But a lot of these other chains that come up have sort of a slightly different view. Otherwise, why don't you just use Ethereum? You have to be able to differentiate yourself. And it's really tough, like that whole concept of why am I building the blockchain? What's on it? How are we going to implement it? It's the same problem that exists with any software solution, right? So other than on the Hyperledger side, really it's taking, let me get a little philosophical for a minute. The two big things that blockchains do, in my opinion, is reduce the cost of verification amongst participants. That's the first thing. And that's actually fairly easy compared to reducing the cost of networking. Because the networking is the economic side. So all these blockchains are really challenged to solve the problem of how do you incentivize participation? How do you reward participation? And how do you do that in such a fashion that it meets all the stakeholder needs? Because in the public space, in the proof of stake space, everyone's sort of buying the coin, the token, or participating in that fashion is sort of like you're raising money that way, in quotes, under certain rules that exist in the SEC and some that don't. And there's like it's more of an open ecosystem. In that closed space, you have a lot more proving. All it takes is one big player to say, wait a minute, and everything kind of starts shutting down. A roundabout way of saying that until you take the private permissioned networks and find a way to really tokenize it, in my opinion, and find a way in which you can gain advantage by using things like crypto economics in these more closed spaces and make it bigger, make it less difficult to participate, the value is really hard to find. Yeah. So that's one of the challenges with the permissioned and private permissioned space right now.
Yeah, I'm sort of making trying to draw a parallel, and this is a place where Lauren spent more time than me, but I think of your world, Tony, where you have some of these, I maybe call them consortium chains, or it's a group of people come together at the start. And you mentioned the sort of, how do you introduce token economics to that? How do you introduce those sort of primitives? But then I'm contrasting that with something like Libra from Facebook, which is effectively, you could think of it as another consortium chain. They've tried to go from the beginning, but very publicly, it costs $10 million to be in the consortium. You're sort of front loading your stake in that way. And so I don't know. I don't think there's going to be a token or even an earning incentive to be part of the consortium, but I'm really curious about why people do that. And I don't know if Lauren, if you have any insight into that, or if Tony, if you have anything to say about it, but it seems sort of like even a hybrid of, you know, a pure private consortium versus a public thing, but you're still trying to get buy-in from multiple companies.
Yeah. My personal opinion is Facebook and Libra is probably a fairly unique case in that respect. You can think of it as, you know, it may be a dominant payment platform. So there'll be some pot of money at the end of the end of the rainbow. And it's like a professional sports league. There's only so many franchises. So even if you're not really sure what the economics look like, you're pretty sure it's going to be successful. And there'll be some money there. So if you're a large enterprise, $10 million is a relatively small number. And so you throw it in there just to be one of the limited set of seats and get one of the franchises, especially even if you don't know what the economics are. So I think that's probably very rare where that's going to occur in any other circumstance. So, yeah.
So coming back to the overall ecosystem, obviously Figment, you're tackling a number of the problems in the space and building technology and building solutions and services for making the ecosystem better for everybody. But in terms of the lay of the land right now, what are the big problems with the space in general right now?
Yeah, I would put two. I'll take one. I would say one is governance, and the other is ease of building applications, essentially. So maybe I'll take the first one, and Andrew can take the second one. But governance is often spoke of and rarely done right now. So we actually have a dedicated governance function. What we found pretty early on that there may be a mechanism, there may even be a set of incentives for people to be involved in upkeep changes to the network, but it requires a fair amount of work. So governance, you know, actually has to be done. People have to write legislation in quotes or proposals. Then you need to build consensus either on or off chain. Then you need to amend the proposals, and then you need to coordinate votes, and then you need to actually implement the change, whether it's a code upgrade or a rules update, etc. So there's a fair amount of work in there, and we've actually turned it into a profit center. We started doing that work. Well, we started doing it because one of our employees kind of went rogue and just started doing it because he was interested in it. But we've actually turned it into a differentiator, both on the staking side. So many of our customers look to us for governance support and advice, and in fact, actual involvement so that we can represent their interests. So it's actually become a selling differentiator, that function. It's also sort of gives us a better view. We know we work with people directly in all these communities. We have better relationships, and sort of people trust us as we move into other areas like developer tools. So, but I just want to point out the governance is another thing that people sort of check the box and like, oh yeah, we've got a governance mechanism, but it actually has to be done. And it's not easy to do. You essentially need an election commission and then everything around that. So I think there's probably some opportunities also to build businesses. I don't know if they're venture businesses, but also build businesses and around governance for many of these blockchains, because it's a valuable function. And it's, you know, if you're lucky, you can get a lot of people to vote. It's more difficult to get to people to actually participate in the day-to-day requirements for doing governance. So that's a big one. I think there's probably a bunch of opportunities there, either, from a people business or a software business or a tools business there. I think if you sort of sat down and spent some time in these communities, you could figure out a good angle there. So that's, you know, if anyone's thinking about a way to maybe get into blockchain and wants to do it, I would suggest maybe looking at governance as one way to do it.
Because fundamentally, the problem is that it's hard to incentivize people to participate in voting and proposing new changes to chains. Is that just because there's not enough of an economic incentive or social incentive?
Yes and no, but I think it's like voting in any system, right? I mean, it's everyone has an interest, you know, in a vote, but any single person's participation is pretty irrelevant. You know, I mean, you know, voting in our country or in most countries is the least you can actually do. I mean, no one person's vote matters. That's unless you were in like some weird state where, you know, it was 50+1. But effectively, the economic rationale in quotes for voting or the utility is very, very low. Just as a fact of governance or of representative governance, right? Your vote does not matter. It really doesn't. And so, you know, I have a line that voting is literally the least you can do if you care. So I think that it just carries over to any governance system, and people are busy and, you know, other people will do it. So there's a freeloader problem. And so unless you're like you have a significant economic interest in the system, then, you know, you just have so many cycles and so many things you can do. So I think it's kind of like fundamental governance itself. So
I think it akin to the homeowner association, again, like people who are super into it, they'll show up to the meetings, right?
Yep. Absolutely. Right. Or who have the time and, you know, are retired or whatever, you know.
Are any of these chains modeling governance off of countries? I mean, let's just take the U.S. federal government, for example. There's a judicial branch, there's an executive branch, there's a legislative branch.
I wouldn't say anything is that sophisticated. I mean, people do use the government, you know, people do use the analogy with countries. I think there's sort of one big problem there is that you don't really have a choice in a country. You know, I guess you can leave. In most countries, you can probably leave, but then where are you going to go? So these are all permissionless, at least the public blockchain. So no one's forcing you to participate and buy the tokens or run infrastructure. So there is an analogy, but there's also a big break between a country. Like, you can't really leave the US. I mean, one answer is, well, just leave. But like, okay, where are you going to go? So you don't really have a choice when you're born here. So I think there's like a pretty fundamental difference. So when people talk about, you know, a blockchain is an oligarchy. There's a bunch of big token holders who essentially control the network. It's like an oligarchy or a ruling class. I mean, I don't think the analogy quite works to a country because no one's forced to participate in these networks. You can just leave, whereas it's a little more difficult in a country. So I think it only works to a point. And no one's really set up that sophisticated of a system yet.
Yeah, I have another frame you can put on governance, which is one is about control. And I think to your point, Will, about are people mimicking nation states? People are trying all sorts of crazy stuff in a good way, right? We're in sort of like the diaspora of governance attempts. You have everything from direct democracy, where one person, one token, one vote. You have representative democracies, where you have to delegate your vote to someone who votes for you. You have something like Bitcoin with no governance, pure consensus, you know, completely decentralized. And so to zero in on our little part of the world, which is these proof of stake networks, the reason I think governance is so important is because each new proof of stake network I view as a little platform that's launching that is desperately searching for a killer app. Or in the traditional sort of startup parlance, they're looking for product market fit. And so what do you do if you're searching for product market fit? You iterate as quickly as possible. Iterate your product, iterate your market. And so I view governance through that lens. Governance is a way to change the protocol. It's a way to update the software. It's a way to iterate on your offering. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think it's so important. One view is just sort of control, but the other view is sort of iteration speed. And if you have a functioning governance system, you can try more stuff. And so then it really gets down to like, is your community feeling conservative? Like, we want to keep what we have, protect what we have. Is it, we want to keep searching and sort of grasping for new ideas. How do you go through this process? Imagine how hard the regular product market fit discovery process is for startups, and do that with the distributed community all over the world in blockchain. Like, that's what we're sort of trying to figure out right now. So wild experimentation. And I think it's super important.
So coming back to Lorian's second point then with regard to problems in the space. So as a developer, right, as an entrepreneur, I'm trying to build that killer app. What problems do I face right now in the space as I go about trying to launch such a venture?
Sure. Yeah. It's pretty, it's all over the map. And I think one of the challenging things is most developers, one, don't know what they can do. They don't even know what's available. And so I think that most people don't even get started because they don't understand what kind of problems they could solve. But let's say you had an idea, and you have some inkling what you can solve. You're going to face a bunch of headwind, and that's going to take the shape of a couple things. One, and this one's pretty well understood, is that sort of the tooling is just not available. You know, you're used to going and saying like Ruby on Rails, you know, create new app. That doesn't exist. These frameworks aren't available, right? We're sort of back in the early days. In addition to that, now if you're a web developer today, you can use AWS, or you could even use Heroku or all these other services for hosting. Most of the infrastructure is not available for you there. We're sort of back in the early days of sort of build your own web server type of days. Mm. And so the way that looks like is the specific problem that a developer will face is, okay, I need blockchain data. Do I have to run my own blockchain node? I want to write my app. Like, do I have to be a DevOps person too? So that's a real, real big challenge is, how do I get access to real-time blockchain data? How do I get access to historical blockchain data? And if you're asking, you know, a mobile app developer to also be an infrastructure person, you know, that's a big headwind. The third is that the sort of community and best practices are really diffuse. It's hard to find, like, where's the blockchain developers community? Where are people are talking about this? How do we kind of iterate to best practices? I've not seen even on Stack Overflow, like, there are some specific people who are talking about some kind of smart contracts. But even that is still very, very early. And so what I would say is that there is essentially two worlds in blockchain development. There's Ethereum and everyone else. And the reason why Ethereum is its own special thing is because they have taken a model where a lot of the infrastructure concerns are sort of thrown out the window. You can write something called a smart contract in a language called Solidity, which you can kind of figure out and learn. But you can just click deploy, and you've deployed it to the world computer, right? You don't have to run any infrastructure. It's just out there. Now, there's some tooling that could be better to do that. There's some analytics that could be better about how's my app doing. But they have created a pretty compelling and definitely the largest developer community in crypto today, because it's pretty easy to get started and there's stuff you can do. And so the reason I say it's them and everyone else is because they're the first to launch. They sort of got critical mass in the beginning, and they've also lowered the barrier to getting started. And so I would say where we're focused is everyone else, meaning all these other blockchains that are not Ethereum. How can you, one, develop a community so that you can sort of try to find product market fit? And that's where we're really focused on creating tools to try to help all these other new proof of stake blockchains.
So let's talk a little bit about Ethereum for a minute. Obviously, big transition happening. Can you tell the viewers and listeners what is that transition and why is that important for the blockchain community?
So. Let's see. They're trying to effectively repair or improve the airplane while it's flying. So just from a pure computer science problem and community coordination problem, it's like an awesome problem to see happen. So they're essentially moving from proof of work to proof of stake for a whole host of reasons, and then trying to do that while keeping the network running. So that's a summary of why it's a massive problem. There's a ton of actors, and that's why it's been slow at a high level, at a super high level. But that's effectively what's happened with Ethereum. It is going to be moving to proof of stake. Those timelines have been pushed out, but I would expect, you know, later this year, early next year, that process will actually start. So,
and why is it doing it? Is it faster? Is it cheaper for electricity? Like, is proof of stake better for the world? Like, why is it going through this transition?
I think there's a few things that are current roadblocks, or sort of they've hit the limit, and things they want to enable in the future. So, one that everyone is pretty familiar with, or or I should say is well known within the space, is this idea of a limit on how many transactions it can process per second. Mm. Basically saying, okay, you can do 15 to maybe 25 transactions per second, but if this is really going to be something that's global and everyone uses, that won't work. And so like the meme is, you know, the comparison is always to like the like global credit card system, how many transactions are processed per second. So, I mean, we are at real limits right now with Ethereum and how many transactions it can process per second. And the, you know, one of the causes of that is this sort of proof of work consensus mechanism. We're sort of at the limits of it. And there's ways you can tweak it. There's parameters you can tune, but we're not going to get an order of magnitude jump in improvement with those configuration changes. And so the idea is that with proof of stake, there's different techniques you can do, wildly different techniques. It's not just swapping out just proof of work to proof of stake. They're actually going to a blockchain architecture, which is very different, which is a sharded architecture, meaning sort of multiple blockchains which have their own little parts of the world that can kind of come together, sort of merge together is one way to think about it. And so, yeah, it's, as Lauren said, I think the name is sort of Ethereum and ETH 2.0, but really I think they're going to be separate chains which might have some links between them, and they're trying to create stuff on the fly. And so I think they're trying to preserve as much as possible a lot of the magic that allowed people to start using it and finding use cases. But it is a technically sort of page one rewrite of the system.
So to dive into the weeds a little bit, how is that going to be different than any of these interoperability chains, like a Polkadot or a Cosmos network? Is there going to be some fundamental differences there?
Cool. Yeah. So this is going to be down in the weeds, but it's one of my favorite topics. So what happens today is that I mentioned there's these smart contracts in Ethereum. Just think of them as scripts. They're scripts that get to run, and you have to pay to run them. They cost gas to run, and you get charged per sort of line of code you run. It's more complicated than that, but think about it. The more lines of code, the more expensive that your script is to run. Mm-hmm. And what happens is what if, you know, everyone in the world wants to run the script at the same time? Well, that's not going to work. So you have to actually pay more money to run your script. And what you have is this, what was currently experienced on the network today, sort of bottleneck of who gets to run their script and who has to pay, who can pay the most money to do it. So everyone's sharing a common sort of state. Everyone's sharing a common space. And if someone wants to pay a lot more than you, they can effectively block you from running your script. But if someone will pay, you know, $10 every time their script runs, then you only have the budget to pay it 1 cent. You could essentially be kicked off the network in that way. And this has happened on accident sometimes. The one everyone likes to talk about is CryptoKitties. It became so popular, it actually stopped all the transactions from going through on the network for everyone else. Mm. It's this big shared space. And so a response to that is to say, instead of having this one huge shared space, can I have my own space? Can I sort of stand at my own blockchain? And sometimes it's called a sovereign chain. You know, I have my own space. And so that is an area of research that you saw a lot of people go down. And so then you sort of change a problem from how do we make this one giant shared space be faster to how do we link together all these disparate sovereign spaces? If you have all these blockchains that are independent and you know you can't randomize parade. If you think back in the hosting days, well, I know you spent some time doing hosting and shared hosting. Like no one's going to kick you off the computer or no one's going to overrun you. Sort of more like VPSs, right? Where everyone has their own dedicated resources. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of shift the problem, which is, okay, now that I have my own chain, I can reason about the activity. I don't have to worry about noisy neighbors effectively. But how do I communicate with my neighbors? What if I want to send them something, right? And so you have this challenge of linking the different chains together. Ethereum 2.0, the strategy is it's one logical chain with all these shards. And each shard, I think that I might be out of date in this, but I think the idea is each shard has the same effectively programming language, the same tools, but there's a very different approach, which is like a network like Cosmos. You can have all these different blockchains which are completely different from each other. And all they share is an API between them, a sort of I think it's called the ABCI, the application blockchain interface, but you can basically tell people how to communicate with you. But it's very, very different between chains. So I'll pause there, but just to say that the response to the popularity of ETH in the sort of giant shared space that everyone's trying to cram into use there's two approaches to it. One is the sort of sovereign blockchain model where you sort of network chains together that are totally heterogeneous. The other one is this sort of sharded model. So sharding is where each different section is very similar to each other, and they sort of are logically brought together. You see that in Ethereum 2.0. You see that in other networks. One's called Near, another one's called Harmony. But those are the two responses to sort of the current technical limitations on Ethereum.
Got it. That's super helpful. Yeah, I've always been curious about how the difference between the sharding and the running more autonomous. And so I think your analogy of the shared hosting versus the VPS in those models, it's sort of shared hosting with a sophisticated sharding algorithm, right? Because it's going to be shared architecture across all the different proof of stake nodes in the new Ethereum 2.0. Yep. Versus I could go spin up my own hub with my own zones in the Cosmos network and whatnot. So let's talk a little bit about Data Hub, right? I, as a software engineer and entrepreneur, have wanted to build applications to surface information from these different chains, help out different token holders with information. It's been a pain to figure out how to build that. Do I scrape different websites? Do I scrape all these different explorers? So tell me about the motivation behind Data Hub.
Yeah. I'll take that first. I mentioned our own path as a company, starting with running these validators, realizing that to get participation from token holders and stakers that we need to create a website, which we call Hubble, so people can see what's going on. In the process of building Hubble, we ran into a lot of the challenges you just mentioned, which is how do we get data off these chains? If we're going to be essentially creating a reporting analytics app, how do we get data off the chains? And so we created our own internal infrastructure. And we found people scraping us because they wanted the same data, right? There's developers who say, this data is valuable to me. I don't know how to run a blockchain node, or I can't, or I can't. I want the data in this format. And so we just sort of followed the natural evolution of what people were doing. We had a problem, we solved it, and we saw people scraping us because they wanted the same data. Okay, let's provide that as an API. You know, the insight was as basic as that. Its starting point was, what data do people want? Why are they scraping us? And so just from a customer research perspective, just keep pulling on that thread. And we identified a few pain points. First pain point was, I mentioned earlier, people don't want to run more infrastructure. They don't want to run blockchain nodes. They don't want to have to patch every upgrade that's coming along as these systems iterate. So that's where we started, was how can we provide raw data to blockchains? And this is really just about reading data off the chain. And what we found is there's more to life than just reading raw data off blockchains. The next thing was, people said, well, I want to submit my own transactions. Let's say that you make a popular crypto wallet and you want to make a transfer on behalf of your users. Does someone who's good at making a mobile crypto wallet also run infrastructure that's highly available to submit transactions? No. So they want to outsource that function. So sort of we just kept pulling down this thread of, okay, you want to read the raw data. Okay, you want to submit transactions. Oh, you wish that the data was sort of enriched or higher level data. You want sort of more than just raw. Oh, you want to be alerted when something happens so you can update your app or something like that. And so that's really the path we're running with Data Hub, is how can we make this data more accessible to people that know what they want to do? And that's an important caveat, people that know what they want to do. That is a pretty small slice of the world. Most people don't know about crypto. They don't know about blockchain. And one of our key bets is that all these new proof of stake networks, they're going to bring something new that developers can do. And so I think what you'll see from us in the future and going forward is, how do we bring more sort of Web2 developers into this Web3 landscape? Mm-hmm. And it's solving some of the things you mentioned, Will, which is most people ask, like, what can I do? What is available for me? Like, what are the new tools for me? I make the analogy to GPS on mobile phones a lot. Like, you sort of give people this new tool, and then they think about it, and they come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. Where we're at now is people don't even know what they can do. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that's not just a challenge for Data Hub to solve. I think that, that these blockchains launching themselves have to do a better job of that. Another issue is documentation. And a lot of the time, the only documentation is the source code.
Right.
And so, that's the reason for that is a whole host of reasons. And it kind of gets back to one of the topics we talked about earlier, which was what's some of the pain points of getting these networks launched. They're so busy just trying to get the dang thing to work that no one's documenting it. No one's thinking about community building. No one's thinking about, like, how do I bring a group of people along with me? And so this is not just something that the Data Hub's going to try to solve. I think the projects will have to try to solve this as well. But, the first phase for us with Data Hub is, for people that know what they want to do, how can we create better and better tools so they can build faster? The next phase, and how do we grow the market, is really about how do we help people who don't know about crypto or who don't know about blockchain, how can we help them understand what's now possible, the new breakthroughs, the new GPSs, as it were. And that will bring them in, and hopefully they'll decide to use our tools to keep building as well.
A light bulb just went on in my head. So Lorian mentioned at the very beginning around the smartphone. It sounds like to me you're building that platform, that operating system, and the proof of stake networks are the connectors on the outside, similar to how a smartphone connects to all these services. You're trying to create one place where people can go and build once, use many.
Mm-hmm. Right? Well, yeah. This is something that I think we don't know. I have an idea, and it's just too early to say. But here's my idea: is that there's a few potential versions of the world, Tony. Which is, I have an application, and I want to run it on every blockchain. Or I want to be blockchain agnostic. And I don't tend to think that is the way to create new novel killer apps. I think what you have to do is see what's unique about a specific chain and exploit it and really try to make it use that in a new application setting. If you try to make it sort of the lowest common denominator, what you really get is a wallet, right? A wallet can operate on every network, and what it can do, it can send transactions. I don't think that's that interesting. And so my own personal vision is that developers won't actually be creating their apps to sort of be blockchain agnostic. They'll be actually trying to create their apps to really make use of the specific features of a chain.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So obviously we've talked about a number of different topics, and I have 1,000 questions, and I'm sure we can do a follow-up. But maybe as a one final question, where do you see the space going? Where is blockchain heading in the rest of 2020 and into 2021? And how do you see Figment playing a role?
You want to take a first shot at this, Andy?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The crystal ball.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I love trying to talk about the future. So the fun thing about the blockchain space is a lot of things are backwards compared to regular world, meaning we run mostly on memes and narratives before they exist, and we sort of will it into existence. Projects can, if their token price is high, that can attract developers to actually go build the thing. And so in a lot of ways, we do things which are kind of backwards, right? If you launch a project which has technical superiority and a low token price, for better or worse, I'm not making a judgment, I'm just making an observation, you're going to have a hard time attracting the community around it. And so the reason I'm leading with this is to say, we've tried on a lot of narratives for Ethereum. We tried on a lot of narratives for smart contracts. The current narrative is one of DeFi, and that stands for decentralized finance. Maybe in the minority. I think DeFi is not interesting. I think it's kind of boring. I think it's a way to automate loans and going long on the token. It's not an actual use case in and of itself. The positive approach to DeFi is something like we're sort of banking the bankless. Anyone has access to a credit facility now. There's a bunch of reasons why I don't think DeFi is interesting, but it is a huge thing that's popular in our little part of the world. Mm. And so that is, if people keep iterating on DeFi, keep pulling on that thread, there may be ways to start replicating more and more of the traditional banking system. One new announcement was from a very popular blockchain called Terra, T-E-R-R-A. They have a new product called Anchor, which looks a lot like a savings account, where you don't have to put in Ether, you put in something that looks like a US dollar, a stable coin, and it bears interest. And there's all sorts of ways to do that, but it's a very user-friendly way for anyone in the world to sort of get interest-bearing accounts on something that looks like a US dollar globally. Mm. And so, I mean, that's interesting. And so I think that's one thing that may happen is on this track of finance, on this track of sort of reinventing banking, like that's a path where I actually don't think Figment's going to participate a ton, or at least I'm not thinking about it a ton. We may. I mean, we run a validator on Terra, and we're big supporters of the project. But where I'm thinking about in terms of which applications can come in the future, I'm more thinking in terms of what can developers build which has not been built before. And so, you know, one of the things I'm very excited about, and I think I sent this to Tony a week or two ago, there's a project called Oasis. And what they're trying to do, and there's a couple of products trying to do this, but they're trying to do computation on encrypted data. And so, you know, you have encrypted data at rest, you have encrypted data that you don't know what you're doing computations on, and then you can sort of, someone else receives it. I think that is a really unique use case of blockchain because you have a full audit log of everything that's happening. I'm excited about these things. These things you could never really do before. And so that's where I'm going to be focusing on. And so I spent most of the time talking about DeFi and saying why I don't care about it. It's clearly a thing. It's clearly going to be, we're going to keep pulling on and see what come out the other end. But I'm more interested in what could we never do before? What was impossible before? And so that's where I'm spending most of my time thinking about.
And I would just sort of second that sort of that comment on DeFi. I think a lot of DeFi is, at least to me, this would be a controversial comment, it resembles the mortgage crisis without any underlying assets underneath it. So I think it's really important that we develop and find that external value capture beyond stable coins and the store value. And then what should happen once that happens, doing those things that you couldn't do before, people use that to solve their own problems and real world problems, and therefore you will generate enough value to actually support a DeFi system. So I would just support, you know, Andrew's comment that I think a DeFi is operating a little bit backwards right now. And first we should be focused on finding those applications that we couldn't do before. So
yeah, did you guys see that video, that video of Jeff Bezos that went around because Amazon, you know, just had their anniversary being founded, and it's him sort of saying why he started with books. Yeah, because there's so many, you know, SKUs on books that you just couldn't put it in the store. The only way to do it is on the internet. And so people will sort of go through all the pains of e-commerce and putting a credit card in because there's no other way to do it. That's the same frame I think about for blockchain. So that's the kind of use case that I think of.
And the big use case for me, and I posted about this as well, so you've seen this, Andy and others as well, is How do we make an experience, an example would be for a physician where they could look across a landscape of tall and wide data and make good treatment decisions on large data sets that may be all de-identified, so you're not exposing anyone's personal information. Today, it's just really, really hard to do that. It's almost akin to the Amazon with books kind of analogy. Mm-hmm. How do we use this blockchain as an infrastructure to enable an experience like that? Where today you have to read tons of journals, you have to go out and get companies to aggregate data, super expensive to de-identify it. How do we do this a little bit differently? Those are kind of what I would call the killer apps when it comes to blockchain as infrastructure to solve really, really big problems. And it's this ecosystem is taking baby steps that direction, and Figment is a big part of that in the public space to help incubate new protocols and new ideas that can go everywhere. The cool thing about this is this code, you can lift it and shift it. Things might go to Ethereum, things might come back out to other systems. They might go into the permission state, the chains. All these things are very liquid, and it'll be really interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't call out one more sort of classic use cases, which I would call massive coordination, which lowers costs. And so to make that less abstract, there's a company, it's a blockchain that we've worked with called LivePeer. And what they do is video transcoding. And they're able to massively coordinate a whole sort of global network of people who want to sort of offer up their CPUs, their GPUs to do this work. And the so what of all of it is by sort of blowing up the middleman, by allowing direct access to this huge pool, they can lower costs by 10 to 100x. That's something you can never do before, right? And so I look for these things, like sort of a minimum of 10x to adopt a new product in sort of the regular world. So it has to be probably like a minimum of 100x to like adopt a product in crypto world. But these sort of dramatic cost reductions are another area where we've seen a number of chains going after, and they seem to be working.
It's really cool. Well, gentlemen, this has been it's been really insightful, super helpful for me. I'm sure our listeners and viewers will also find a number of these topics fascinating. And I think there will be a number of questions that come up after this. So thank you. I think at the final question is, where can people find you online, both personally and more about Figment?
So you can find Figment at either you can join our Staking Hub channel on Telegram, or you can go to our website at Figment Networks, figment.network, or also on Twitter. So all the usual channels. You can find me on Twitter at Lorian Gable, one word.
Yep, and I'm AJ Kronk, AJCRONK on Twitter.
Yeah, for me, Dr. Tony Little on Twitter. And if you look up Anthony Little and Optum, you'll find me on LinkedIn. So thanks, right. Will.
And we'll make sure to put these in the show notes as well. So thank you again. Really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to probably and hopefully having a part two at some point in the near future.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you, guys.
Later, right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
All right. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. As a reminder, if you're listening, you can view any of the episodes via video at wclittle.com. Also, a few quick things. One, I have a general newsletter where I write about emerging technology, software development, blockchains, startups, and a lot of the content that we discuss on this podcast. So go to wclittle.com and hit subscribe. That site is actually a new project that I've helped create called Satchel. Satchel is a simplified online publishing and newsletter platform that helps facilitate the communication between creators and their audience. Also, I want to bring to your attention a product called Startup Rocket. If you go to startuprocket.com, you can learn about how to create a new venture of your own. And Startup Rocket is a portfolio company of Proto Ventures, which I mentioned in the intro, is the operator investor group that I'm a part of, and I'm one of the general partners. So thanks for listening. I'll look forward to future episodes. And go to wclittle.com and subscribe to the newsletter. And if you think of it, if you could leave a review for this podcast anywhere that you listen to your podcasts, that would help get the word out so others can listen to the content as well. Thank you.